Good morning and welcome to another Tuesday edition of Community Conversations. We are trenching right along into January, into 2022. Welcome back, Julie. You've had a good new year in Minnesota, I think.
Yes, I started the new year in Minnesota, Phil, and I must say I'm happy to be back in Sandpoint because it was quite chilly. I had a night of 20 below. I'd kind of forgotten what that felt like. So actually, I'm happy to be back in a little bit of rain and snow here.
Yeah. Well, the rain is a mixed blessings, as we've been talking with a few folks. Bringing some snow off the roof is a good thing, but the puddles on the streets and the puddles up at Schweitzer have a lot of folks disconcerted.
Yes, it's a wet time. It certainly is. And the driveways are not very drivable either, is what I'm finding. I find myself slipping and sliding and having to wear my Yak Tracks anytime I want to go outside. It's awfully icy.
Wear your traction devices. And if you don't have them, you're out of luck. The stores, I think, are all sold out, although maybe they're getting more in now. They were sold out a week and a half ago.
Maybe so. Well, something that doesn't probably have too much trouble in ice, or at least less trouble than we have, are the animals out in the outdoors. Maybe the deer don't like them, but I bet the birds aren't too bothered. And the snow and rain maybe gives them something to drink, although there's some awfully big snow piles. I don't imagine deer are enjoying trying to find food right now. And I mention that because our guests this morning are American Heritage Wildlife Foundation, and we're joined by the Executive Director, Kathleen St. Clair McGee. Hello, Kathleen.
Good morning.
Good to have you. And volunteer Diane Newcomer. Hello, Diane.
Good morning.
Diane, I'll mention, is a former board member for us here at KRFY. It's been a while, but we sure enjoyed having you years ago. And we may have a final guest, and we'll bring her in if she's able to make it. So we'll just go ahead and get started with Kathleen. If you would give us a bit of an overview of the American Heritage Wildlife Foundation, the history, mission, goals.
Well, the Wildlife Foundation began as just a vision in the late 1990s, and we became a reality in 2001 when I started completing all the paperwork. And that was the paperwork for the 501c3 status, the state nonprofit status, as well as all of the paperwork involved in obtaining the rehabilitation permits from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Department, as well as Idaho Fish and Game.
Well, go ahead, Phil.
That's an excellent quick synopsis. Tell us when you started, where you saw it going, and are you there yet?
That is a loaded question. Well, we have made a lot of progress. 20 years has been a long time, and we have helped a lot of wild animals. We've made a lot of connections with people. We've educated so many folks on how to be a good neighbor to the native neighbors. And so that's been something that's been very helpful. Our mission is twofold. Number one, primarily, obviously, is to rehabilitate the injured and orphaned native animals, but also to provide education for the community so that the community can live more peaceably with the native neighbors and try and reduce those conflicts so that those patients aren't actually delivered. 90% of patients that are brought in for rehabilitative care are due to some form of human interaction. So that being said, the demand is ever greater that we need to have more help. It's ever greater that we need the financial ability, ever greater to have more outreach events and activities. And the goal, the grand vision when this was first started, was to create a nature center, the first Inland Northwest Pacific Nature Center. So someplace that is very educational for the community. People of all ages come out and learn and experience what it lives, you know, what it's like to live where we are and to really appreciate where we live and understand and love where we live.
Sure.
So we're not there yet.
Is the Nature Center still something, though, that's on your mission statement, still something you're working toward achieving?
Always.
So how did you get involved in this? What's your background, Kathleen?
Well, I used to work at several zoos, as well as a horse ranch and an animal shelter. And because of my zookeeping background, when I was working at the domestic facilities, the people would come in and ask questions about the different little, the little wild animals. And I would get all the phone calls referred to me about the little wild animals, about the little birds, the little squirrels, you know, my dog brought into this, or my dog chased to that, my cat brought into this, or my kids found to that. And so they kept throwing me all of these wild animal questions. And my background was exotic animals in a captive setting. But that's kind of where it really sparked the thought process of this area really does need a center for people to call and identify. Because if you connect with Idaho Fish and Game, their resources are exclusively for the game management. And they just don't have the resources to extend any further than that. So that's why this mission, that's why American Heritage Wildlife Foundation is so important to the area, because we really do need to have a facility where folks can learn about all the different aspects, because there are no other facilities that are left non-game. You know, for the non-game, yes, for all the little birds, all the non-game mammals, all of that, all the little ones that are just as vital, just as equally as important as all of the, you know, the mega fauna, mega flora.
The ones we see on our table.
Yeah.
Well, that brings us to Diane Newcomer. And Diane, you are one of the volunteers at the American Heritage Wildlife Foundation. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do there.
I do as I'm told. I'm not doing very much now because I don't get around very handily. But I've fed baby birds, which is great fun. Mm-hmm. And I discovered that we had a
sapsucker
who didn't like to eat out of the, and he ate sap. And he didn't like to eat it the way it was being prepared. So I discovered that if I rubbed it in between where the boards come together, he ate it. So that was kind of exciting.
Yes.
And it's just, I like animals. I live on a ranch and I've always had kind of a menagerie. So it was an easy thing for me to want to do.
Yes. And you don't live too far from there.
No, about what, 7 miles maybe?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
That helps.
It seems like a very natural extension for both of you to have come to this place in time, but it's yes. Interesting. It's an interesting place too. North Idaho's full of wild animals. Tell us about how you feel a certain need here that nature doesn't.
Who was that directed to?
I think either one of you.
Well, I think the fact that I've seen the rehabilitation of raccoons and squirrels. Of course, there's a lady in Sandpoint who
used to be.
She's retired now.
She's retired, yes.
But saved many, many squirrels. And she works with Kathleen on occasion, or has in the past. Mm-hmm. Again, the clock is kind of catching up with
all of us.
Thank you. That was nicely put.
Yes.
But the raccoons are certainly some of the cutest animals. And I guess my favorite was the baby skunks. But I was worried about that because she told me what I needed to do. And then she had to go to her other job. And I thought, okay, that's fine. But skunks are notorious for odor problems. And these are fully equipped baby skunks. And the solution is that you pick them up and always keep their tail firmly underneath them. If they can't raise their tail, they can't spray.
That makes sense. Now, the other animal I can think of that probably has really specific handling instructions would be the porcupine. Any experience with that, Kathleen or Diane? Yes.
I haven't, but
yes. Yes, I do have experience with porcupines. They are also another one that is handle very gently, handle with care. Yes, make sure you have the proper safety equipment. It is, yes. But that's a very valid point. You know, when folks talk about, oh, I want to come out and help and I want my children to come out and help, you are confusing caring for your domestic dogs and cats with what it's like to care for the wild animals. And so the wild animals, raising and rehabbing of wild animals, is entirely different from, you know, raising up your puppies and your kitties, because you can't, your puppies and kitties, you pick them up, cuddle them and love them, and that's what you want. That's how they thrive. You do that to a wild animal, and not only is it very, very stressful for the wild animal, it's potentially dangerous for you. So that's one of the issues that's very different.
Yes, and if you do turn it into a friendly pet, that's also not what we want, is it?
Exactly.
That's correct. That is absolutely correct. And when those kind of situations happen, and when that arises, for example, a very tender-hearted, wonderful human being finds a wild animal, they bring it into their house, they raise it up with their dogs, their cats, their kids, their chickens, their whatever, and then they expect this wild animal to be just open the door and go back and be wild. And now when it doesn't, unfortunately, it's always that wild animal that is going to be at the loss, because that wild animal doesn't have that fear. It doesn't recognize that it shouldn't want to have this bond. And that's the fortunate ones that are able to bring up with the right nutrition, because so many times, well-meaning, good-hearted folks, they think, oh, the internet will tell me how to do this. And so they research and come up with all kinds of concoctions to try and provide the right nutritional needs. And more times than not, they fail. And so that wild animal is now struggling and suffering, instead of that person just engaging their brain and calling the professionals, calling the folks that have experience. So it is very important to make sure that when you do have questions, to connect with your local professional.
And so for clarity here, it is your goal or hope or mission to rehabilitate the animals and then release them. This isn't long-term convalescent care. So you're trying to maintain that wild nature with the specific
animal. We
try
for it not to be.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. the permits definitely mandate that they come in and they go out. That's our permits.
Because they would be. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'd like to add something in that, just because of what we've been talking about, obviously we're handling the animals. You can't just stuff a bottle in a cage with baby anything and expect them to drink from it right away. So you do have to handle them, and the little birds, the small squirrels, do get handled, but you'd be surprised how quickly they learn to eat without being handled. And that's our goal, is to stay as far away from them and handle them as little as possible. Like birds that need bits of meat or something like that, we can give it to them on something like a long probe or something, rather than actually touch them. We touch them as little as possible.
And do you try to mask yourselves at all? I think from other programs I've heard where feeding particularly young raptors who are going to be released, the human acts sort of like a puppet, so that it's mimicking the adult.
You don't think we're scary enough?
No.
You can answer that one.
Yes, we do find ways to remove or reduce the human presence as much as possible. Yeah, we have very strict rules when you volunteer, very strict rules to be a volunteer. There's no talking in the room. There's no music playing. There's no big conversations. We wear masks. And that's the underlying thing, is to remember that even though you as a volunteer are caring and well-meaning, that animal sees you as this great big scary monster. So again, we try and do what we can to reduce that there's actually a human near them. There's no strong odors on us. Nobody's allowed to wear perfumes or colognes. It's very strict rules and regulations. And it's all with the end goal of, this animal needs to stay wild. This animal needs to want to scratch us, bite us, peck us, growl at us, run away from us when we get anywhere near it. You know, if that's what your animal does on the day of release, you can pat yourself on the back. If your animal hates you, you're a fabulous rehabber. So it's kind of counterintuitive to what you would.
And what is our current rate of release?
We are in the 50 to 60% realm of release, mm-hmm. which is greatly above the national average. The national average is only 30% success rate. If you have a 30% success rate, you are a rock star. But that's because 90% of your patients are from human cause. So if you have a 1-pound bird that gets struck by a 3,000-pound car, what kind of trauma is that going to happen? So it's all goes back to that trauma that animal is sustained, why that animal is with you.
Yeah, it really does. You know, it's interesting what you've just been talking about, because the people who are wanting to help the wildlife obviously love and care about them. And that's why they sometimes do the wrong thing by taking them in. And then it must be a challenge for your volunteers, who I'm sure have come to you with also the intention of loving and caring for wildlife. And then, of course, they, as you just told us, they've got to be as, you know, not in the animal's presence as possible. I bet that's a bit of a challenge and a lot of education.
It is. We have protocols. There's training pamphlets that we read through. We have PowerPoint lectures to help guide and assist and provide new volunteers with as much information as possible. We network with other professional rehabbers in the nation as well as in the state. When we have cases that come through, we're very open on trying to provide as much information as possible to help the volunteers all understand and remember, okay, this is entirely different. And we just set those protocols in place so that you always fall back on those protocols. It's not something foreign to you. You're already familiar with what you're going to be doing on any given day.
So clearly, from everything we've said, the role for volunteers is limited to those who are very well trained and vetted, if you will.
But they don't start out well trained. You can come anytime, Phil.
Okay. That is one of the next questions, is how do people who want to help, how can they help then?
Well, and it's also, everybody thinks, oh, you're a rehabber, so you just need animal help, animal people that are going to be interested in that, or people with animal backgrounds. No, that is not true. Operating a rehabilitative nonprofit center is like operating a regular business without having your clients and your patients with the ability to pay you, as well as not having a storefront to have products to sell to get your funds. So there's a lot of other aspects that we require volunteers to help us with. That's the marketing, managing, promotion of our products, promotion of all our fundraising activities, creating fundraising activities, creating different outreach events, attending the educational aspects, connecting with the schools, having nature guides come out for our nature walk that we have set up and established. There's a lot of things happening that you can get involved in. It doesn't have to have you be there every day tending to wild animals. So there's a lot of ways for the community to step up. There's a good two dozen, three dozen jobs that we need to help with.
Nice.
In answer to how do you get to be a volunteer? And yes, there are so many volunteer areas that don't involve the animals, but if your interest really is the animal, we can train you. You can have never touched a baby bird, and Kathleen will show you how to do it and do it safely.
So yeah, you can give us a call or check out our webpage at ahwf.org, and there's going to be a lot of information on that page about the different volunteering tasks. There's going to be a volunteer orientation form to fill out. So you can either email at us, or by all means, again, hop over to the webpage, ahwf.org. You can also connect with us on any of our social media platforms.
And I would add that the nature walk that is usable now and the ultimate hope for a nature center is kind of the bridge between the families, the kids, anyone that would like to come and see the animals. And we really can't do that. Our permits don't allow it. But the Nature Center would take care of that, would help a lot with that.
Yeah. Help people learn about what animals they might encounter and the work that you're doing.
Mm-hmm. So there's an important distinction I want to make sure our listeners are aware of, that a visit to the facility isn't a tour of the animals, that the nature walk encompasses other values or places that you'd like to expose them to, other educational aspects.
That is correct.
Well, Kathleen, why don't you walk us through a year in the life of a wildlife rehabber? I'm sure there must be busier and less busy times. Here in the depth of winter, what is it looking like? Do you have many new patients taken in?
In the depths of winter, the phone calls do decline. Unfortunately, the phone calls that we do receive in the middle of winter is more times than not are from an animal that has usually been struck by a car or is suffering from lead poisoning or some type of extreme debilitation So that their first stop after assessing the situation, more times than not, usually that's a situation where this animal is suffering and it's suffering greatly. So the next stop is usually connect them with a veterinary clinic that is willing to work with them. And unfortunately, this time of year, most of the patients are just a situation where they need to have their suffering ended. So new patients in winter doesn't usually happen, but we do occasionally get some new patients in the middle of winter. But wintertime is a time when our volunteers all get together, and this is the time when we decide what kind of events we want to have. Traditionally speaking, we did have the Clean Comedy Show every year as a major annual event. This is the time when we get that going and that organized. We pick and choose the different schools we want to connect with. So it's a lot of planning about the future events, be it fundraising and educational. It's also time when we can review the intern applications for university students that are interested in learning about rehab that want to come out in the summertime. So that's what we do also in the middle of winter. It's kind of a time to regroup and process and think about, okay, what kind of supplies do we need to order now so that we have them available for us in a couple of months? Whereas, as you stated earlier, what is it life in the year of when it's busy season? For example, this spring, I was putting in 18 and 20 hour days every day for about 3 months in a row. So, and that was because there was not a lot of help that was actually being there. So everything fell upon my shoulders. So there are days that are a lot heavier than others that it could have been lightened a little bit if there were additional volunteers, but then it's nice because we do have a drop down in the daily demand and it comes more of a mental busy work instead of physical busy work.
And I'd like to suggest that you tell them about the internships.
So yes, the internships are, again, you can find those applications on the webpage, ahwf.org, or give us a call, 208-266-1488, and we'll be happy to talk with you about what the internship means. And what that is the university students, or even just any student that's over 18, anybody that is interested in that aspect, maybe wants to go into veterinary medicine or biology, any kind of wildlife studies, any kind of focus like that. If they want to learn how to handle and restrain, feed, the importance of proper nutrition, medication, that kind of thing, to connect with us, because this internship will introduce you to many, many aspects and facets of caring for animals that include zookeeping and so forth. You'll learn all those things that you're going to find helpful. It is a weekly stipend for those students, and in return, those students learn so much. They gain so much experience to go along with the knowledge that they've learned from the books. And it's anywhere from a 2 month to a 3 month program. So again, that application for the internship, the summer part-time seasonal internship, is on the webpage.
And if they enjoy responsibility, they will have lots of it.
Yes, they will.
But it is a summer internship. Do you have a similar program for any other times of the year?
Well, this year we'd also like to, anybody who's interested in or has knowledge of the native plants and so forth and is interested in the educational aspect. We're also looking for to help out with that, or a couple people to help out with that. There's the groups on the nature walk, also to reach out to the schools and provide those lectures to the school groups, to the library groups, that kind of a thing. So yes, if there are folks out there that have that knowledge of the flora and the fauna and interested in teaching, then absolutely connect with us on that aspect as well.
Yeah, one of the things, excuse me, I was going to be sure and not cough. We do have a program that's sort of at rest currently called Know the Neighbors. And it's aimed, well, actually for young and old. The first time we wrote a grant for it and Cal gave us the money to buy the equipment. And the plan was to go to schools and daycares and so forth with this program, thinking of little kids. But I actually wound up taking it to several of the senior housing units. And the first one, after that, we shifted the name a little bit to know your wildlife neighbors, because this one gentleman was really quite miffed at me, because he was expecting that he would come in. Here I came with all these animal information, and he was really expecting me to have brought the neighbors in, and he would get to meet Mrs. Jones from over here and that lady that I see out in her backyard all the time. So anyway, that is still available. And as I say, it's between COVID and aging. That's kind of, it's hibernating.
Yeah.
But that is available. And anyone that was interested in it could call and we could arrange, we can bring it out.
Yeah, very nice. So this question comes to me all the time when I think of wild, you know, native, just wildlife rehab and taking care of animals that are in distress. And I don't know how you'll even answer it, but I find myself wondering, is there a hierarchy that you establish for what animals you can and will help and those that you won't? You know, for example, what about the native species that invade into the area and that folks that are very interested in maintaining native plant and animal populations would be unhappy to have rehabbed? How do you deal with those kinds of sort of, I guess, rehab ethical questions?
That is definitely a very important point. And the short answer is each individual rehabber across the nation sets their own policy. Each individual rehab center decides whether they will or they won't rehab the invasive species, the non-natives. And each facility then comes up with their own guidelines on the rehabbing and their response to the community for these non-natives. At our facility, because we are so limited on so many levels of our resources, we are pretty much stuck with, okay, our permits cover almost every species we have. So that's 200 and some odd different species that at any moment somebody calls, hey, I have a this, our permits cover us, so we need to be able to jump up and provide care for those. So when someone calls up and says, I have this non-native, this introduced species, will you care for it? We just simply cannot stretch our resources to expand to a non-native. And so we do our best try and guide and educate on what that person can do to help that animal. But our resources, we have to focus on when to say no. And that is one area where we can say no, because we need to focus where we are the most effective. And the most effective is with the natives, and our permits cover the natives. Our permits do not cover the non-natives. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so if you got a rhinoceros, you just probably couldn't deal with that.
Well, on a practical level, what are the species you might... Yeah. What are the species you might be asked about that you're not able to take care of because of whatever concerns, whether it's because they're not native or lack of permits or other questions? Is there a short list of we can't take these animals?
So that's a good point. So if you look in your guideline book that's from Idaho Fish and Game, they will list a starling as a predatory species. And starlings, European starlings, are obviously introduced, and they are very aggressive, very bold. They are not required to be listed on the federal permits. The federal wildlife agencies do not encourage rehabilitating starlings because they are so aggressive, and they will actually kill the different native birds. They will decimate crops. That's why Idaho Fish and Game lists them as a predatory species. They will, anybody who has orchards and so forth knows how destructive they can be. So our group, for example, someone calls up and says, hey, I have this nest of birds. It was on the site of my house. Same goes with the little English house sparrows. I have these little birds, they fell. I will guide you through on how you can care, or I can guide you through on connecting with another national entity to try and locate another rehabber that can help you with those birds. But for our group, we just cannot accept the starlings or the little house sparrows, that kind of a thing. And it, again, it boils down to limited resources, as well as it does, Julie, you said it a little bit ago about the whole ethical dilemma. It really kind of is on an ethical thing of, you know, I'm going to raise this animal that is going to be destructive to the natives, and the natives are having a hard enough time surviving. So why am I going to encourage something that is going to cause problems? And not to touch on a very hot topic, but it's kind of the same thing about feral cat colonies. Why am I going to have a feral cat colony and right next door my neighbor is a whole bunch of native plants to bring in all the native birds? It's counterintuitive. It goes kind of against an ethical, it's a moral dilemma. It's each person's individual choice on what they do, and our organization is deemed no.
So in a larger sense, someone finds a distressed animal. Mm-hmm. Are there quick guidelines you can provide for our listeners as to when to call you versus to call Idaho Fish and Game, and not just who to call, but what actions to take while they're waiting for something to happen? Should they be bringing it to the agency or waiting for someone to come out? What should someone do?
Very, very, very important question. Absolutely. So as far as when you first see an animal, just remember American Heritage Wildlife Foundation, just remember AHWF. So first is A, are you aware of what you're supposed to be seeing in your neighborhood? The wild animals that you see, you should be aware of what's normal. H would be for hesitate. Hesitate before you approach any wild animal. Keep your distance and watch and observe for signs of distress. And we'll get into signs of distress in a minute. But again, you want to watch. So there's your W. F is follow through with connecting with the proper authorities. Now the proper authorities, you can do a national search for rehabbers near you. Animal Help Now is a database you'll be able to connect with. If you live in Chicago, Animal Help Now, Bink, it'll connect you with a rehabber near you in Chicago to help you and advise you. Most of the rehabbers are volunteers though. They're working at other paying jobs. So you have to kind of be patient and wait for them to call you back. Or if the animal is experiencing extreme trauma, then the next step is going to be connect with a veterinary clinic. And that Animal Help Now database does have different veterinary clinics that work with wildlife, so you can connect with them. Now, the signs of distress you're going to be looking for and listening for is the animal vocalizing. If that animal is just vocalizing nonstop, that is not normal. A wild animal is not going to be drawing attention to itself unless it really is in need. Are there any visible wounds? Is there matted fur? Is there matted feathers? Is it missing feathers? Are there some kind of parasites? Are there fleas and or any kind of maggots? Is there any kind of bad odors? Is there open mouth breathing? Those kind of things. So something, if an animal doesn't seem right, if there's something wrong, then absolutely those are going to be signs of distress that you need to follow through with the right steps. And that checklist is on our webpage. So there's some really fast, simple little questions on the webpage, ahwf.org, for you to see. But then you just need to be patient and understand that you're talking with a volunteer, as well as I need to help as well. I can jump up and be a hero myself and actually drive this animal to you once I'm told to drive it to you, or drive this animal to another rehabber or to the veterinary clinic. Unfortunately, it's not like a fast food place where you pull up into a talk into the thing, say, hey, come get this animal, and you're done. That's the end of your responsibility. It is not like that. Everybody needs to pull together and work as a team. Let's see. So that would be okay. So while Diane just made a really valid point. For example, someone says, okay, I have a raven. It's out hopping in my backyard. It's not normal. It doesn't seem right. And what do I do while I wait to bring it in? You want to keep that, again, remember, this is a wild animal. Keep it calm, keep it quiet, keep it in the back room. Don't let your dogs and your cats and your children all handle and touch and bump and smell and disturb, because that adds extra stress. Like we discussed earlier, a wild animal is going to be fearful of humans, and now it knows it's hurt, so it's going to be at a level of stress to it. So you want to just keep these animals calm in a box in your very back room while you wait and while the next step is decided.
Could you throw a towel over it or something to pick it up?
Yes, absolutely.
And put it in a laundry basket.
That's correct. Yes, laundry baskets are fabulous.
I always think about food and water. You know, like I'll have a, if I've got a bird or whatever, I always feel like it needs some, like, oh my God, the poor little thing, I need to feed it and water it. But is that important or not?
That is a fabulous human condition. Everybody's a good Italian mama. We all,
right?
Analogy I like to use would be, if you're climbing up in your tree and you're trimming a limb and then you fall out of the tree and you just land on your back in the middle of your front yard and you're laying there saying, ouch. Oh, do you want your neighbor running over and say, oh, I'm here, have a Big Mac and shoving your food in your face? Or do you want your neighbor just to kind of sit quietly and, oh, I can tell you hurt.
We're, I don't know. I would take the Big Mac.
We'll take your mind off things for a little while.
Well, this has been really interesting. And, you know, before we run out of time, we should make sure we touch on other things that are going on or will be going on in the coming months or year. What is the rest of the winter and spring and maybe even early summer look like?
I'm sorry. Can you repeat that, Phil?
What kind of events do you have coming up?
I would like to say that we have, that we've brought back our clean comedy show. I would like to say that we brought back our scarecrow event. I would like to say that we brought back so many, but to have all those events, we need to have committees and people involved with the event planning. So unfortunately right now, no major events come to mind, but it's only January. So we do have time to plan and coordinate.
And the surge of COVID certainly makes you think twice about public event.
Yeah, it's a tough, difficult time for that. So yeah. I guess the best thing to do would be to stay tuned and find more information on the website.
Correct. That is correct.
Yeah. And just keep observing the wildlife around you and trying to be a good human neighbor to all of the animals that are out in the world. And first step, not to do damage to them. And if we find a damaged one, to seek out the proper care and attention so that we can hopefully help them as needed.
And I think you'll be doing programs at the library and
hope so.
We'll go out to schools if called and so forth.
Yes.
Okay. Well, do you have information on those upcoming library programs?
No, we're still very much in in the behind the scenes.
Okay.
There is a set of prepared programs, however.
We do. We have 24 different PowerPoint lectures on 24 different topics that are specific to our area, specific to the wild animals, specific to conservation and being a good neighbor. As well as one on how to be a bad neighbor so that those wild animals kind of move along and don't want to live in your yard if you don't want to live in your yard.
Yeah, right.
That could be useful.
Yes.
Well, I think we're running about towards the end here. Any last thoughts for our listeners before we go?
Our group this year, we had so many phone calls. We were easily 30% more need, 30% more patients taken in this year than in years past. And we had a 60% increase in our number of phone calls. We were almost 500 phone calls this year. So that being said, there is more and more demand on our small group to step up and help the community. But what the community needs to remember, we can only help the community if the community helps us. So we need folks to find ways to look at their schedules and get involved with, oh, well, I can help on this fundraising committee, or I can help with the spring highway cleanup, or I can help with just coming out and doing laundry once a week, or talking to a school group on the nature walk once a month. So there's many areas. It's just looking at your schedule and making it an important point to help keep Idaho wild by helping us help them, and in turn, help yourself.
And you might really learn a lot. There would be so much one might learn about wildlife, and helping out in your organization would have to be a very feel-good experience. And the thing that I always think about is that, you know, volunteers, we always think we're going to get sucked in and it's going to take up all our time. But as you've just mentioned, you can do one small thing and it will help your organization.
Okay. So why don't we leave with the best way for a volunteer to connect with the HWF?
Best way to connect would be telephone, 208-266-1488. That's 208-266-1488. That is a landline, and you will need to leave a message. Next best thing would be drop us an email, ahwf@sandpoint.net. That's ahwf@sandpoint.net. We are in an area where internet and connectivity is non-existent. So you might have to wait a couple days for an email to get back to you. That being said, in your area, I imagine you do have Wi-Fi. So by all means, check out the webpage. There is so much information on that webpage, ahwf.org.